Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
What do we get right and wrong about the grid, and how can we fix it? We'll discuss all this and more with guest Brad Viator as part of a special sponsored series on energy. We'll be doing five of these episodes sprinkled throughout the next several weeks. Your regularly scheduled programming will return with our next episode. Our sponsor is ClearPath, an organization devoted to breakthrough energy technologies that you can find at clearpath.org. Brad Viator, by the way, is the founder of Be Strategic, and you are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast.
Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
All right, so situate yourself a little bit for our listeners. Who are you? How'd you get interested in this topic, get into this area, and what's the organization?
Cool. I spent about the last 11 years working for the trade group for all the investor-owned electric companies, the Edison Electric Institute, and ran all of their external affairs, state policy, which everything about electricity, all the money is made and investments are determined really at the state level. So what happens in state policy is pretty relevant. I left EEI at the beginning of the summer, started my own consulting firm. I guess I'm learning. I'm an energy expert now. I had no idea that that was the case as we were sort of getting there. And I'm focused on kind of a couple of key issues, but one of them being making investments in the energy grid and ensuring that people have access to affordable, reliable service.
All right. So we hear a lot about the grid, especially when stuff goes wrong with the grid. What is the grid?
Yeah, it's a complicated machine. It's a collection of, I forget what the number is. It's like 36,000 machines all connected to one another across the U.S. It's actually a series of grids that are really just interconnecting one locality to another. And it's a function of really how electricity is produced, as to why it's designed in this way. When you originally were building the energy grid, you know, back in the days of Edison and Tesla, what we were doing is we were going out into areas where people didn't live, and we were putting up things like coal plants or oil facilities, right? And we were producing power, and then we were sort of delivering, ultimately transmitting and then delivering that power to where people lived. So, you know, the rural areas around New York or Washington, D.C. or Dallas were where the coal plants were. And then we built these big high voltage transmission lines to carry that power across like broad expanses. Then once we got into cities, we built out a distribution system where we would bring that voltage down, lower the voltage, and bring it into every home kind of across the country. And that was just historically how the system was developed. And then, you know, technology kind of came in, people started to live differently. And so we started to kind of repurpose that energy grid, and it's created some opportunities. It's also created some pretty real challenges.
So I'm sitting here in my house and my laptop is plugged in. It's actually not plugged in. I shouldn't say that. I'm always truthful with our listeners, Brad, but my phone is plugged in. So there's some power plant in the vicinity here, and I'm connected to that power plant, but is that power plant connected to other localities? And then those other localities are connected to other power plants. And then that's,
it's more or less how it works. If you're getting power right now, there's a turbine spinning somewhere. Like it is a real time sort of thing. And so that's something to like, I think it's worth appreciating. Like if your light switch works, it's because there's power that's being produced right now. It is one of the very few sort of like real time assets that that we deal with. But that's right. Like there's a power plant it'll be allocated more or less to a particular locality. There'll be a couple lines that might come out of that power plant and sort of transmit that power to various places wherever the need is. Physics takes over a little bit, and sort of demand on one end sort of forces the electrons through that transmission pipeline.
So do they roughly need to know how much electricity I'm going to be using and everyone in town is going to be using, because they can't do too much and they can't do too little?
Yeah. I mean, it's super important to be able to predict what demand is going to be, because you need to ensure that you have power supply available to meet mm-hmm. that demand. And there are like a couple really good examples of like what happens when it doesn't match. I think the best example in recent years is that disaster in Texas in February of 2021 after winter
storm. And that's because everyone needed more than they had?
Yep.
Because it got colder, and so everyone's turning on the heat, and it overwhelms the system. And then what happens? Just stuff fry out, or there's just not enough electricity to go around?
There's not enough supply, so they have to actually like at the bulk power level, at the like sort of system management level, they have to cut customers off so the whole thing doesn't explode, more or less. Mm-hmm. So like if it doesn't match, everything fries, kind of as you were saying, right? Mm-hmm. So what the grid operators do in that instance, it's called a load shedding event. They kind of go out and they're like, all right, well, you're not going to have power. So sorry, dude, like go about your day, figure out something else to mm-hmm. do with your day. And that is to keep the entirety of the system operational. And that's like really bad news. And we're having more and more of those load shedding events in two jurisdictions in particular, in California and in Texas. Like those two places are, you know, kind of smoldering dumpster fires for different reasons. And then
let's talk a little bit about that. Let's go first California, because we love talking about California's problems. Texas problems, not so much, but we'll talk about both. But what California, a month or two ago, you know, there's stories about you know, try not to use electricity from 5 to 8, you know, when the sun's going down, so we don't have so much solar, but apparently is a kind of a peak time for people using electricity. Don't plug in your electric car, et cetera, et cetera. So what's going on there, and what are the issues with their grid?
Yeah. So I'll start kind of at a high level of the sort of like California the biggest California symptom as I see it. And this will make sense to a lot of your listeners. You know, California is not a place that likes to eat its broccoli. They are interested in investing in what's next. They are interested in sort of figuring out how they're going to revolutionize everything. And so resources flow to the next kind of whiz bang thing, right? And there are other sort of like public policies that are kind of layered on top of the management of their energy grid that just make it hard. Like, you can't use coal in California. You can't build new gas plants in California. You retired two enormous nuclear facilities in California because the public or politicians interpreted the public's opinions to mean, hey, we just need a bunch of renewables, right? So you essentially pushed a lot of the dispatchable resources off the system. And that posed sort of some very real kind of operational problems. On top of that, and what I think is actually the thing that connects California and Texas and New England is, do you remember those, that little sleepy little company out of Houston, Enron? You remember those guys?
I don't know. Smartest guys in the room.
So the smartest guys in the room, and this is also what's kind of happened over in the UK, they decided to build, to restructure electricity markets and build all these restructured electricity markets where they separated the ownership of generation, distribution, and transmission. And the Enron guys wanted to be these big competitive generators that were going to go out and buy all the power plants and save money for everybody, right? Well, when they did that, they created all these incentives where people don't invest in generation. So the generation system gets really old and decrepit, and there's not enough power to meet peak demand. There's just enough power to meet regular demand. And like, that's fine 360 days a year. But when the weather goes haywire and you don't have enough resources online to meet peak demand, you get blackouts. And like, we live in a world where like blackouts are unacceptable. Like, we rely on it for our phones, for our MacBook. We're Zooming now, right? Because of the availability of this resource. If you're not ready for the worst day, then everybody's going to be pretty pissed and your system is going to look a heck of a lot more like, you know, Pakistan than it does the United States. And that's kind of like a fundamental problem, I think, in California.
And how about Texas?
Yeah, it's kind of the same, right? Like the Texas problem, and I can say this as a Texan, who frankly, I moved into electricity and energy because I thought it was my path to move back home to Texas. And about a year in, I was like, oh my gosh, Texas is a smoldering dumpster fire. I can't do that. The Texas problem is all about like cost, right? And Texas wants to be competitive. They want to pull all these companies out of California, and they're going to do it because their energy costs are lower, right? But Texas just doesn't invest and it doesn't eat its broccoli. It wants to cut costs at all costs. And so you have a system with razor thin margins. So if energy demand increases at all, your system's kind of smoked and you've got to do rotating outages. So while there are different policy drivers that led California and Texas to get to where they are, it's kind of the same problem. Like there's not enough generation to meet the need. And the last thing I'll say about Texas is it's like the most Texas thing possible. Texas is like all about veneers, right? Like fake hair and fake other things is kind of the Texas way. And so you have a system that looks good, but doesn't hold up. Like it's no surprise that there's a $250,000, like, you know, 6,000 square foot house because it doesn't have any insulation and it uses inferior building products. Like that is kind of the Texas way, the home of the $30,000 millionaire, right? And its energy grid and the investment in the energy grid are similar.
So who does it right?
You know, to be honest, it's a little bit surprising to think about it this way, but they do a really good job.
You're not going to say Vermont, are you?
I'm not. No, definitely not. Vermont's pretty bad. It's not as bad as the rest of New England, but it's pretty bad. The Southeast does a pretty good job. So does the Southwest. And the thing that they do in the Southeast and then also in the Southwest is they make significant infrastructure investments, but because they're sort of the traditional model of electric delivery and electric distribution, they plan it out for like 30 years, right? And so they're like, all right, I'm going to make these investments and I'm going to do them year over year. And as a result, costs are spread pretty evenly and consistently across customers. And there's not a ton of volatility in that investment, right? Like the only volatility they have to deal with is, you know, fuel costs. So they do a pretty good job there. You see outages that are, you know, the outage numbers are way better in those regions of the country. Parts of the upper Midwest as well actually do a pretty good job.
So what do we need to be doing in general to upgrade the grid and have the kind of grid that we want and need for the future?
Yep. We need to do a couple of things. Like the challenge right now is there are a bunch of rising costs. And there are, in particular, a bunch of rising costs around natural gas, right? Like, I think we're seeing it. There's, you know, clearly a war in Ukraine. And even though natural gas isn't it's not traded on an international market. It's traded locally. We're still seeing, like, some significant price increases. The price of natural gas is up 3.5 to 4 times what it was 18 months ago. And so that, like, flows through and impacts customers. And so I think one of the challenges that you're going to see is that, like, as people's energy bills go up, there's going to be less and less interest in actually making investments into the system. But investments in the system are exactly what we need to be doing, right? Like, we need to be sort of improving and upgrading, in particular, the distribution systems, and then we need to be building more transmission systems. So, like, there are a lot of movements in a lot of parts of the country to either underground infrastructure or upgrade infrastructure in cities. Like, we need to do that. You know, one of the challenges that we see in places like New England is that, you have this distribution system and you have a bunch of trees, but you have policymakers that won't cut down trees and they won't trim branches, right? And so what does that mean? That means that those untrimmed branches hit power lines and the power goes out, right? So you need policymakers to draw reasonable conclusions, which is like, hey man, I know if these trees hit the power lines, the power goes out and my people get pissed off. So I should probably do something about the trees, or I should do something about the power lines, right? Like, let's either put those power lines underground if we really care about those trees and invest a little bit more money, or let's do the rational thing and trim that maple. Like, I think there's like a lot of things that can and should be done at the local level that are kind of just common sense, right? Like, if we care about this resource or we care about this infrastructure, let's take care of it. And I think sort of regular maintenance is one of the big things that we need to be thinking about. And then, you know, kind of just investing and upgrading the system. We've got this, like, and I think love it or hate it, we've got this electric revolution that's coming, right? Like,
this is the solar and wind and all that stuff.
Well, solar and wind, but also like electric cars and like everything, right? Like,
right. Oh, what do you mean, more things being electric? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking about electrifying everything. And I know that, you know, some of us on the conservative side of the ledger are skeptical of the electrification of everything, but I don't think there's really anyone who will deny the fact that we're about to have a lot more electric demand. Right.
So what besides cars is an example of other things that'll be electrified?
Yeah. So like, I've been in discussions about electrifying seaports, electrifying airports, changing the operation of like sort of, you know, diesel generators at manufacturing facilities, right? Like, if all that stuff moves to electricity, if we're talking about electrifying, you know, trains, if we're talking about electrifying, you know, heavy vehicles, that's a boatload of demand that's coming our way, right? And I think
So that just means they won't be running on, you know, petroleum or diesel anymore. They'll be electric.
Yeah, that's the idea, right? Like,
so less fuel, less fossil fuel, more electricity. Although,
I mean, some of that's fossil.
I get the electricity as a.
Yeah, but like that seems to be the sort of like a policy decision's been made that, like, look, electricity is a pretty great resource, and sort of like emissions can be controlled at a bulk level in the way that they aren't controlled with petroleum, right? With petroleum production. So you should be like, hey man, I'm just going to put a bunch of demands on what, like, output from electric generation should look like. And if that becomes the feedstock for cars, if that becomes the feedstock, you know, for these other sort of industrial implementations, I guess, it's a way to make a pretty significant impact. So I think whatever you think about that policy push, I think it's pretty hard to escape the fact that, like, more things are going to be electrified and there's going to be more of a reliance upon electricity. So if we're going to do that, we probably should invest in this electric system that is going to enable all that stuff. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that enough places around the country are eating their broccoli and sort of like making those investments that aren't the sexy investments.
Mm-hmm. So let's just go back a second on burying stuff. Are there advantages to that besides just avoiding the predictable outages when the wind blows and it rains or snows and trees fall in the lines?
Yeah, I mean, the other one is aesthetics. Like, we see a lot of buried power lines in, like, very affluent neighborhoods, right? Like, you don't see those suckers overhead on Palm Beach. And so I think there's some aesthetic advantage to it. You don't really deal with weather, but there's also some downside. Like, you may recall a few years ago, was it like 4 or 5 years ago, when we had a storm surge and some pretty massive flooding in New York City, where the power lines are undergrounded. The problem that ended up occurring there is that, all right, so now we flooded out a power system that's underground. And so if we had just hung those suckers up on trees, we could have rewired and rebuilt the thing in like a day. Now we've got to wait for water to recede, and then we've got to go in and work with infrastructure that's essentially underwater. So it took longer. Like, the power, if it's undergrounded, the power goes out less often because there aren't big weather events. But when it does go out, it takes us longer to rebuild things, right? Because we've got to be subterranean to do it.
And is the power going out? You know, it happens wherever I've lived. Besides New York City, really, it's happened. I remember when I was a kid, you know, there'd be a thunderstorm. I was in Virginia, and we'd have our candles, you know, in the house. But are there serious economic costs to every outage, or is it just the sheer inconvenience that you are, whatever period of time, plunging people back into medieval existence?
Totally. Huge costs. I mean, like, electricity is the feedstock of our lives. Like, you know, think about that for a minute, right? Like, if you don't have electricity, like, what are you doing? You're sitting at home with candles. You're hoping that, you know, you're going outside and like cooking all your meals on a barbecue. Like, I mean, it's cool for like a minute, but your phone dies and you can't see updates on, you know, whatever, Instagram or TikTok, and your kids are on fire, right? Like, it's more than an inconvenience. And like, you know, production stops. Like, you don't necessarily think about the fact that, okay, so I'm from the Gulf Coast of Texas. I'm from, like, you know, the refining alley. And like, down there, you know, all the oil that's produced and sort of utilized in the US is produced in that region of the country. When the power goes out, the refineries don't work. Like, they are dependent upon this thing, upon this electricity to produce gasoline, right? Like, it's the feedstock for everything. If the power goes out, what are the traders on Wall Street doing? Like, how does that stuff work? Mm-hmm. How do financial systems work if all that's out? How does, you know, Amazon Web Service or Google Cloud, that stuff doesn't work if their power's out, right? So the economic costs are enormous, and everything's super interdependent. And so, you know, I don't know. To me, it's like it's like at the bottom level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like, let's go in and ensure this stuff works. And then because this stuff works, we can sort of do other things on top of it.
Yeah. So speaking of New York City, I think it was Sandy, but there were just these really spectacular, you know, videos of transformers blowing up, you know, these blue explosions. Was that just inundation by water, or were they being overwhelmed in some other way? I don't know.
I'd be interested to figure it out. I don't know what was exactly causing the explosion. I mean, the water could be interesting. Water could be a cause, but I'm not sure. I'll dig in. I'll let you know.
Okay. So, on broccoli. So before I interrupted you, went back to the underground, burying the wires. You're saying, you know, we need to do kind of more eating our broccoli kind of things. So that's sort of infrastructure upgrades that would not be strictly necessary right now. You know, you're still going to get power, you know, most of the time, but that are necessary to get in a better place and be prepared for the future.
Yeah. I mean, like, great example. I think a lot of people are familiar with that enormous wildfire out in California, the Camp Fire. And just that, like, the devastation that you saw at the campfire, right? And as they were sort of rolling through litigation, kind of figuring out what happened, they're like, oh yeah, this little hook that was 100 years old that held up the transmission line broke because it was 100 years old and its useful life is 40 years. So like there's a lot of stuff on the energy grid, this sort of like really complicated system or a connection of systems that was built 100 years ago that like, you know, things just need to be upgraded. It's like the plumbing in your house, right? Like if you live in the mm-hmm. Northeast, your plumbing's old, man. And so like you got to go in every now and again and you get a leak and you got to replace that old lead pipe with PVC. The same types of things need to be done on the energy grid to give it another 30, 40, 50 years of life. And don't just throw your money at the next whiz bang thing, right? Like as you're making energy grid investments, don't just think about, you know, energy storage or renewables or hydrogen, a bunch of things that have a lot of promise and are probably necessary, but they probably shouldn't be done at the expense of these kind of like more basic infrastructure investments.
And are we talking about infrastructure investments at the local level, state level, federal level, all the above?
It's more local and state level than anything else. Like the role that the federal government will play is creating a bunch of grants and tax credits. You saw this in the last bill. Can we talk for a minute about the Inflation Reduction Act as a name?
Yeah.
Maybe we'll save that for another time. But like there were a bunch of grants for grid resilience that exist in that bill. And so that's cool. Great. Like, but most of those investments are made at the state level and most of those investments are approved by the Public Service Commission. But now there are some big grants for some specific things. So as opposed to all that money having to be laid out on your electric bill, there's opportunity for electric companies and others to kind of apply for some of those grants to offset some costs. Like that's not all bad. To sort of be able to utilize some common dollars to invest in grid infrastructure. And I think that'll be an important thing to watch going forward.
So is there any, ideological valence to policy decisions about the grid? You know, conservatives tend to have one view and progressives another, or is it more of a kind of meat and potatoes practical issue and the contention more is over just, you know, how much we're going to spend?
Yeah. I mean, yes, there is some variety between the liberal point of view and the conservative point of view. So I'm going to be very, I don't know. And I'm going to generalize a lot here, but here's more or less how it goes. Liberals are like, yeah, whatever. Let's just replace all fossil fuels with renewables and let's invest in the next thing because, you know, the climate risk is real and this is our opportunity to kind of change everything. This is what we need to do, right? Like, let's just go do that and let's kind of abandon other things. Conservatives are like, renewables never work. We don't need renewables. Like, that's a bunch of hogwash. Like, let's just figure out how we're going to run these coal plants full bore. So like those are sort of like the differing point of views and the place from which mm-hmm. we begin. And they're both like pretty flawed. Like renewables are pretty cost competitive and are a great resource when the wind's blowing and the sun's shining. I mean, they have zero fuel costs, right? So like from an economic perspective, it's awesome that you don't have to spend any dollars on fuel. And they're also like relatively cheap to build, right? So like those things have a place. And I think there are more conservatives that are kind of picking up that mantle at this point. And I think that's important. And I hope that like those conservatives are able to move the broader conservative movement into a place that sort of appreciates that like everything should exist in a portfolio, right? So that's kind of the thing on the conservative side. On the progressive side, I think, you know, you're beginning to see it. And like environmental NGOs sort of make this a little bit hard. But like, you know, you need to be able to call on a resource to turn on when you need it to turn on. And like, you can't do that with just renewables. Like you could do it if you were pairing some renewables and storage, but like the best storage we've got right now is like 4 hours of storage. And that's not sufficient to get through that piece we were mm-hmm. talking about earlier, the sort of 4 to 9 in the summertime period. So like, I say all that to say that that's kind of the perspective, but all that stuff's about generation. Nobody thinks about the transmission or the distribution of power. All they think about is either I'm a coal guy, a gas guy, a nuke guy, a solar guy, or a wind guy or gal, right? And like, that's a problem because, you know, like 70% of the electric system is wires and nobody's talking about that. Mm-hmm. Like, people care about wires when it's going to like come through their property, right? If it's going to divide your farmland, people are like, oh, we don't need that. You know, we don't need takings or whatever to solve for this electric system. But as a practical matter, like, that's kind of exactly what we need. We need mm-hmm. more and more of those big transmission lines to bring power to where people are.
So do the wires change depending on what your mix of generation is? Are your wires different if you're predominantly coal as opposed to wind or solar?
Rich, no, it's a good question. Like, do we need different wires because of different resources? And like, the answer is like, we don't need different wires, but we do need sort of more wires. And the reason for that is that like, wind resources and solar resources are probably going to be in different places than where the old coal plants were, right? And so you're going to need to build more transmission to connect new development. That's kind of the thing. Like, we need more because new stuff is getting built all the time and it's not all getting built on old sites, right? So you've got to build transmission systems to sort of like solve for that problem. The other thing too is that like, particularly with wind energy, wind is not the best wind isn't where the people live, right? Like, it's in rural areas. There's a ton of great wind that's offshore. That's a big discussion right now about like offshore wind. But that's like super far from where people live. And so if we're going to go out and we're going to put up all those turbines, we've got to build transmission from where that wind is to where people actually are. You got to get into the suburbs of Chicago or into Denver or whatever, right? From where that wind is. And so that's going to require more wire investment.
So how about the issue, by the way, of security? You know, you hear a discussion about, you know, malign actors hacking into our grid. How much a worry is that kind of threat?
Look, I think that threat's real. I mean, you know, when your counterparty is like, when your counterparties are the Russians and the Chinese, and they could sort of like impact and embed and influence the flow of electricity, like that threat's pretty real, right? I think the solution to that is actually redundancy. I think it's about having more outs and having like a system that is built to meet even greater demand than today, right? Because in that sort of environment, like if a section of your power grid goes down, you have something you can replace it with, and you've sort of built more roadways and pathways to generate electricity. Like, you can't have single points of failure. And so I think that's what a lot of the grid folks are working on, is like, okay, if I lose this whole segment of the system, how do I keep things operating? And it's about avoiding single points of failure. And it gets back a little bit to the thing I was talking about before with the like restructured to deregulated electric systems versus the like traditional electric systems. In the restructured systems, you've got a bunch of middlemen that are operating, and you frankly just have more owners of assets. Mm-hmm. Heck of a lot harder to control a system that has a bunch of owners as opposed to a system that has like a larger single owner. So there's some other factors that are there, right? Like, it's like, you know, you run a small business. What are you worried about in terms of cyber risk? Somebody taking their laptop home and opening an email, right? if you were sort of like controlling everything at the bulk server level, you'd be less concerned about some of these threats. And I think you sort of have similar challenges in the electric system as well.
So to conclude here, paint for us your most pessimistic scenario for what would happen with our grid and the most optimistic scenario if we do everything from your point of view the right way here.
Yeah, I think the pessimistic scenario is that what happens in our country is entirely determined by where we live. And I think you will continue to see poor policy decisions in New England, in Texas, in California, and those grids sort of increase demand, don't increase supply. We see more collapse in almost like just what we have now, but an accelerated hellscape version of it, where essentially like the power systems just don't work there because they're built or they're designed. These sort of markets are designed in such a way as to not reinvest in the system and not solve for future problems. I have less of that concern in those parts of the country that I said do it well, like the Southeast, Southwest, parts of the upper Midwest. But there is a push right now by a bunch of the guys that sort of like benefit from the power system in Texas that are trying to bring Texas style energy policy to other states. So I guess there's another worst case scenario where, you know, those charlatans are able to convince the people that are doing a good job and making good investments that the Texas way is better. So I get a little worried about that. I think you could probably say the California way too. So that's like a worst case scenario. And then we've got an incredibly divided country when it comes to like, you know, access to electricity. That's probably the worst case scenario. I think the best case scenario is that we're able to sort of take a portfolio approach to everything. We're able to first understand that we need to invest in the sort of the basics. We need to eat our broccoli and we need to upgrade transmission. We need to upgrade, just the entirety of the distribution system. We need to underground in particular places. We need to continue to invest in things like natural gas. We need to invest in things like nuclear power, but renewable shouldn't be forgotten, right? It's sort of like taking a holistic portfolioed approach to these investments is what's going to be necessary. And that's like a really hard thing to do in this sort of like quasi market that the Enron guys created. And I get worried that I get a little bit worried that like the fake market that the Enron guys created is something that conservatives are going to glam onto because it says market in the name. And that's like not really what it is. Right. And so it's not a market at all for the big reason. Maybe I'll ask this question. You're smart dude, understands economics. Do you know what what's a replacement good for electricity? I'm curious. Do you have a thought?
A replacement good in the sense of something that would give us the same benefit?
Yeah.
I would say nothing.
Candle maybe? And so like...
yeah, I guess so.
I worry about like this whole idea of creating a commoditization in like a market where you're, you know, essentially saying it's a commodity, right? Like if the price of corn is up, I can eat beans. Like, if the price of ethanol is up, I can use gasoline, right? I worry about the whole concept that we use to design, that the Enron guys use to design these markets. And I think that, frankly, it's just not a market because there's not a replacement commodity, right? And so I get concerned that that sort of idea that made sense to a bunch of like Harvard economists like 30 years ago is fundamentally flawed. And like, really what we need is a little bit more planning. Like we need stakeholders to come together and be like, all right, cool. What's the system we want? Let's go build that. We don't need other like externalities kind of getting in the way of us, you know, eating our broccoli and building the system that we need.
Awesome. Brad, well, I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much for your time.
So that's it for us. You've been listening to a special sponsored edition of The Editors, courtesy of ClearPath, an organization devoted to breakthrough energy technologies that you can find at clearpath.org. Again, our regularly scheduled programming returns next episode. And of course, any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Union Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We're The Editors. We'll see you next time.